I'm very pleased to welcome back, well, he hasn't really left, you from the Roundhouse, Professor Martin Drum from Notre Dame University. Welcome, Martin.
It's great to hear Michael, and I should be welcoming you back from your travels. It's great to see you.
Well, it's lovely to be here. I've completed the waterfronts of Turkey and Greece study tour for 2025. I've learned a lot, but I have been watching the politics from afar, and I've really enjoyed your discussions with your colleagues, fellow cephalologists, and the like. And I know our listeners were fascinated because there's been a lot of people listening to them. People couldn't get enough. But Martin, the time for getting enough is just about over. It's Friday morning, both in Sydney, where you are today, and in Fremantle, where I am this morning. And the people who haven't voted already, haven't rushed into the polling booth, for example, in Fremantle Mall and cast their vote, will do so tomorrow, and tomorrow night we'll all be glued to our television sets. Martin, the first big question, I've sort of assumed that Elon Musk is in the background and is holding a big checkup that has $1 million US written on it. He's apt to do these things to influence elections and outcomes, Martin. And he says to you, Martin, I'm going to give this to you, Martin, $1 million US dollars, made out Martin Drum, Professor Martin Drum, to make it really legal. Tell us who's going to win. No sitting on the fence. Who's going to win this? Who's going to be in government in Canberra come Monday, Martin?
Well, you can't put off a prediction any longer than the day before, can you? I'm predicting Labor will return as the government and following tomorrow night's counting. And there'll be a lot of things uncertain on the night because there's so many people voting away from the major parties. There'll be a lot of what we call three-cornered contests. So that's where there's a Labor, Liberal and some other candidate, whether it's Green or Independent, in the race. And they'll have to wait to see who they're doing the final count between. So there'll be plenty of seats still up in the air. But I'm predicting that we'll have a second term of the Labor government at the federal level.
Martin, just remind our listeners, the really acute ones will have it all up on a whiteboard as we speak, and they'll know what the difference is between the parties in the current parliament. But what is the state of the current parliament, and what are you predicting it will look like later?
Yeah, so the state of the current parliament is Labor has 78 seats. They won 77 and they picked up another one in the by-election. The coalition has 57 seats as it stands, on paper at least. They've had a couple of people that have become independents, but they've got 57 seats notionally coalition. And then there's a range of other seats, 18 other seats for which there's independents and greens and minor parties, a combination. So there's a big crossbench. As it stands, I think there'll be a big crossbench after the election. We won't be certain at all whether there's a Labor majority or not. I can't be certain about that. But I think that Labor will get close enough to the 76-seat majority they need to govern again. And look, the mountain that the coalition has to climb, starting with 57 seats, they need another 18, 19 seats to get to majority. And I just can't see that happening tomorrow.
There's been a lot of negative commentary, Martin, about the quality of the coalition, particularly the Liberal Party campaigning. Everyone seems to have piled on and made similar comments. Do you join with the commentariat on that?
I think it's a bit of a mixture of internal and external factors that affected Dutton's campaign. It's never one thing. So the external factors is, I think that it probably had his tail up when Donald Trump won. And we learned that Donald Trump, at least one of his advisors, was giving Peter Dutton's team some advice. And they thought that a similar campaign might be good. I think that they would have liked to run on a stronger anti-immigration, cutting excess, government spending, all of that kind of thing, smaller government campaign. But Donald Trump has become deeply unpopular internationally because of the tariffs and the other signalling to other countries, and that has hurt Peter Dutton by association. So people are assuming that there's a commonality there, fairly or unfairly, Michael, but I think that's just the reality. He sought to distance himself from the Trump image, but it's very difficult to do that in a short period of time. And I think that's affected his campaign. So that's the external factor, Michael. The internal factor is there's been a series of missteps and miscalculations along the way. He said he'd be cutting down on public servants working from home. He's backtracked on that. There's some confusion around tax breaks and what he supports and doesn't support there, and a few other grey areas as well. And for the most part, because it couldn't go hard on some of those other issues, he's mostly matched some of Labor's commitments, offered a fuel tax cut, for instance, that's temporary, and a few other bits and pieces. But I don't think any of that's shifting the dial. And the other thing that's external, Michael, is I know we might get to the Canadian campaign at some stage, but it's a time for incumbents, I think, at the moment, in a period of global uncertainty. And I think that's something that's helped Anthony Albanese as well.
That's been the ultimate Trump factor, hasn't it? Trump got elected and he's had all these things to say, and he just had his first 100 days and signed a record number of executive orders and had his red tie wearing, blue suit wearing cabinet, all men, I think, gathered around him. Well, there might have been one woman in it. But it's the declaration, the imposition of the tariffs, which has upset world trade. And it's scared the bejesus out of everybody, Martin. And of course, add to that that he wanted to take over Canada, and right up to the death knell, if not after it, was still proclaiming that he was going to make them the next state, which of course didn't go well in Canada. But do you think the Canada experience plays in this campaign as well?
I think there's a bit of that. I don't want to overegg it. What happened in Canada is the Liberals, which is our kind of Labor Party equivalent, centre left, they were getting smashed. They were 25 points down, and they pulled off a massive victory, a significant victory. So we haven't seen the seismic change because we're further away. Trump has not come out and said he's going to make Australia the 51st state of the US. It's not quite as visible as that. It'll still be a close election. But it shifted enough. It shifted about 3 points. And in a tight race, we've gone from a real kind of 50-50 scenario, not knowing exactly who would win, to being a bit more confident that Labor will get back in. Hasn't been a big shift, but might be just enough in a close race.
Well, it's amazing, isn't it, when you look at Canada, a bit like the Dockers, coming from a 25 points down at three-quarter time and knocking over a Collingwood by 5 points at the end. But Martin, what are the polls telling us this morning? Are they still widening the gap?
Look, no, they're still reasonably tight. So we had a lot of 52-48s. Now, bear in mind, about 6 or 7 weeks ago, it might be closer to 2 months ago now, you had probably 51-49 coalition, right? They're now being 52-48 Labor for the most part. Some 53-47s Labor. I did see 51.5, 48.5 Labor that came out just recently, just yesterday. That's one poll that's paired, tightening there. There's another news poll due overnight, which is always an interesting one. So it's one. It's probably about. I think that sometimes they slightly overstate Labor in some of these polls historically. It might be 51.5, 52 Labor at the end of the day. That'll be enough for them to retain government, maybe or maybe not in majority though. That's the part with a big crossbench. Anything can happen. There's some discussion about preferences, Michael, because so many people are voting away from the major parties. The preference flow through to the candidates and seats is going to be very interesting and a bit unpredictable this time around.
Yes, well, you keep reading about the preference deals and who's putting whom where, and whether One Nation, Pauline Hanson's going to be a kingmaker or a government maker in all of this. To what extent does political science tell us the extent to which people just follow the how-to-vote card?
Look, the highest, if you able to engineer a preference for around 80%, which sometimes the Greens have managed with Labor, that's a very high preference flow. And traditionally, One Nation's been much lower than that in flowing through to the coalition. I think it's because some One Nation voters are just far-right voters, right? But some of them are just disenchanted, just, had a gut full of politicians, et cetera. So it's a mixture. And they've never had a preference flow quite that high. So preference flows matter to both sides of politics. We want to be clear about that. There's also independents that will run in seats, get a sizable number of primary votes, and not win, and have to, their preferences will be distributed. That will be influential as well. So that's all makes things difficult. When we used to have straight Labor and Liberal finishing 1-2, the preference counts would be done on the night. We'd be pretty confident we know who's winning. When there's three or four parties there, we saw this at the recent state election, it's going to take longer because you've got to wait to see who's going to finish 1 and 2 and then conduct your preferences accordingly.
Martin, if my memory serves me right, when I was a very small boy and my parents would go off to vote, and before the famous split in the Labor Party, 98% or so of the voting public went for one of the two major parties. Nothing like that now. What do you think it's going to look like in terms of primary support for the majors at this election? I mean, we'll know soon enough, but there's a big drift away from them, I have the feeling.
Yeah, this is a historic trend. It's continuing. It's fairly consistent. It's not limited to this election or the last one. It's been dipping up. You're going to get primary votes. I think we can predict with a fair bit of confidence, both in the low to mid 30s at the most. You're going to get an aggregate from Labor and the coalition of around 2/3 of the vote. And the whole third of the vote will be Greens, Independent, One Nation, minor parties. And that's really a significant seismic shift in the Australian voting patterns. It's happened over about the last 20 years. It's been growing, and it has ramifications. We're starting to see a much bigger crossbench, Michael, than we've ever seen in our House of Representatives. That crossbench may grow or diminish slightly. It will not disappear. It will still be substantial after this election.
Martin, when you pick up the voting slip for the House of Representatives, the lower house of parliament, it's not a difficult thing. It's not overly challenging. For example, in Fremantle, there's half a dozen or seven candidates, and you have to put in the numbers and in the order you like them. But if you pick up the Senate slip, Martin, it's longer than a toilet roll if you spread it out, and every man and his dogs seem to put their hand up. I think you and I are the only two who aren't standing for office, either individually or according to some party with a fancy name. Tell our listeners, tell me a little bit about the way the Senate's structured now, how many are going to the election, and what do you think the trends will be or are in the Senate in Western Australia? How many new senators are we going to have?
Yeah, look, some really good points. Every vote kind of matters in the Senate. So even if you live in a fairly safe seat, it's going to really matter. Normally, the Liberals have got three of the six Senate seats up for grabs in WA. Labor's more recently typically got two and the Greens one. At the last election, Labor did much better than they've traditionally done, and they actually got three. So we had three Labor and one Greens, which four out of six went left. And that's actually a significantly different outcome. This one might fall back to the sort of 3-3 sort of left-right scenario, but there's a number of different factors there. The Greens hovered around one quota. Whether they get one quota in their own right this time, not sure. One Nation were the next best performing party that didn't get a seat, so they got a significant uptick. They could win a seat here, and legalized cannabis is the party next best performing party. They were still a fair way off the mark, but if more and more people are voting away from major parties, anything's possible. And that's why so many parties stand for the Senate, because they think they're an outside chance. And look, the quota is about 14.3%. So if you get 14.3%, you're guaranteed a seat. If you get about half that, you're definitely in the race. So, if you get 7 or 8% of the vote, you're a shot at a Senate seat.
It's amazing. And what about the people going off to vote? You can just put a number above the line or under the line, whichever way it is, where you can just indicate that you're going with that party and however they allocate their preference count after that. What do most people do?
Most people vote above the line. So basically, there's a line, literally a horizontal line on your paper. Most people follow the instructions above the line, where you number 1 to 6. and or more if you want to, allocate your preferences accordingly. And that still gives you every opportunity to both vote for your favorite option and also preference who you like. If you're quite a discerning voter and you know your candidates, you can vote below the line. You have to number 1 to 12 there. You're instructed to know number 1 to 12 there. I am happy to disclose I usually vote below the line, Michael. I like to select the candidates I like, etc. It's a bit more time consuming, though. I realise it's not for everyone, but that's an option for a more limited number of people that want to preference the candidates that they know and the ones that they like. So you can do that. You've got that option as well. Typically, around about 95% of people vote above the line. So I know I'm in the minority.
95%. Well, I can understand it. By the time they've filled in all the numbers in the House of Representatives, they just want to get out of the polling booth and go and have a coffee. Too early for a beer. That'll be later on in the day. But Martin, let's bring us to Fremantle. We've had an unusually, you might say, unusually active campaign periods in Fremantle. We had the state election where a community independent candidate, Kate Hewlett, nearly knocked over the State Minister and Labor Party, longtime MP for Fremantle, Simone McGuirk, and he lost by about 400 votes. If 200 people had voted differently in her favour, she would have won. And she's been making a big presence for this. You can't quite tell if there's any reliable polling to suggest what's happening in Fremantle. Do you have any good oil on the
Oh,
contest?
look, I've sort of heard that there's some internal polling that I think might have been Byclimate 200 that suggests that Kate Hewlett is gaining traction. I expect her to do pretty well. I expect her to poll to take votes off all of the Labor, Liberal, and Greens candidates and make quite a splash. Whether she wins is, of course, another bar. That's a high bar. It's a high bar at a federal election. The federal seat of Fremantle looks different to the state seat of Fremantle. It's a much bigger electorate. It's got a lot of southern suburbs that are more typical suburban areas. There's a plus and minus to running for the federal seat after running for the state seat. The state voters, state Fremantle electorate voters, will know Kate a bit better because she's ran previously at the state electorate, and so extra visibility. But those voters outside the state electorate of Fremantle won't know her so well. I expect that she'll poll best in immediate areas around Fremantle and the northern part of the electorate, and probably not won't perform quite as well in the south.
Well, Martin, it might be like using the football analogy. All of the players have trained hard all season. They've played a lot of the games. They've had a few injuries. They've got to the end, and the season's over. And the footballers go off, and much to everyone's embarrassment, have something called Mad Monday. They dress up. They drink too much. They embarrass themselves, everybody else. But what about political scientists, the cephologists, when the campaign's over, the vote's in, what do you do? Do you have a break? Do you go and read some comics or do something interesting?
It's kind of like Christmas, I think, for us. We get very excited. We are nerds. We follow this stuff with great interest and great granularity. I'll be doing a bit of blogging. I'm away this weekend, but I'll be doing a little bit of blogging along the way, which will be a bit of fun. And I'll do a bit of radio tomorrow on the Sunday as well, which will be fun. And for me, it doesn't stop on Sunday night. For anyone involved in the actual campaigns, it doesn't. They'll be watching the seat by seat results come in well after Saturday night. I've sort of indicated that there'll be a lot of things unknown on Saturday night. So Lake County will be very interesting for us as well. So we get a longer period of fun, Michael. It might go for at least 3 or 4 days, or maybe longer.
And you and I, of course, will be back next Friday to wrap it all up, see what happened and how accurate all of these predictions were. So, Martin, let's bring it all to an end in a fairly snappy sort of yes and no answer way. First question is, and you've already answered it, who wins, elbow or guts?
Yeah, like I said, I think Albo will win. He'll form government. Like I said, can't predict how many seats he'll win exactly, but I think he'll be back in for a second term.
Second question is related to the last comment. Is it going to be a slender majority he gets, or are you a bit more comfortable than present?
At best, it'll be a slender majority. It may still be a minority. I think that's a very real prospect. I couldn't, but the hard bit is knowing exactly how well the crossbench will perform. It may be an even bigger crossbench than the one we have at the moment, and there's, it's either a very slim minority, it's a very slim majority, or a minority government we can expect.
The next question is, Martin, just what do you think the Senate will look like? Will it still have a pretty useful, from a general governmental point of view, crossbench?
I think it'll look a little bit similar to the one we have now, in that there'll be opportunities for the government to pass legislation. The Greens will be important, but I doubt that Labor and the Greens themselves will have enough numbers. But there are, senators like David Pocock in the ACT and others that will be options. Maybe Jacqui Lambie, those kind of senators, there'll be options for passing legislation. So. They won't have a majority. They won't get close to a majority in the Senate. It's a very diverse House these days.
And the last question is the Fremantle question. Josh or Kate? You've indicated Josh. Is it Josh by nose or Josh in a canter?
I think it'd be Josh. I think it'd be narrow. I very hard to predict individual seats, but I think it won't be a big victory, but it won't be quite as close as we saw at the state election.
Martin,
But not on a knife's edge.
it's been wonderful joining with you, and you joining with your colleagues over the last little while in the federal campaign. We'll, as I say, be together again next Friday to see how it all finished up. But good luck with all your commitments over the weekend, and thanks for being a fabulous commentator on View from the Roundhouse.
Thank you, Michael. It's going to be a great weekend. I'm looking forward to it.
See ya.